the patient hunter stalks his prey. Not a clean shot? Perhaps another day. When it finally happens, click, muzzle flash, boom. The jaguar falls from the tree to his doom. And now comes a tricky part. Is it really dead? Hey, Mark, can you take your axe over to that thing's head?
Am I sounding okay so far? Does this make sense, or is it too ramble?
Hear ye, hear ye, all ye who hear this here podcast, know this. This podcast is for entertainment purposes only. Nothing discussed on this podcast should be considered investment advice. The hosts hold no licenses and are not financial advisors. Do your own research before making investment decisions, and we do hope you enjoy this podcast.
All right, everyone, we're ready.
Mark Cahotas, welcome to TC's Chartcast. So great that you could join us.
Thanks for having me. This has been a long time in the works.
Certainly has, and should disclose to the audience that we've become quite good virtual friends in the COVID era. And as you said, it's been a long time coming, and we're thrilled to have you on. You've heard many of our episodes, so you know what's coming. Why don't you give the audience the full bio sketch on Mark Cahotas? I've listened to you on many podcasts, but I can't say I've ever heard your bio and life story. So why don't you begin with where you were born, where you were raised, and sort of sketch the arc of your life.
Okay. I'm from Chicago, Illinois. The arc of my life. I was never really good at school. I always used to say, even at a young age, never let your schooling get in the way of your education. I graduated high school in the fourth, fifth of my class, which is the bottom, toward the bottom rather than the top. I used to sort of ditch high school and work as a runner on the Midwest Options Exchange. No one really knew that, and sometimes I used to go to see White Sox games, get in with my buddies for $3 a day game, so I was never one for school. So all these Harvard, Princeton, Yale, Stanford guys, if you think you need to go there to make something of your life, it's 100% false. Graduated high school. I went to Babson College in Massachusetts. It's a great school now. When I got in, they were looking for people from the Midwest, and I wasn't much for school, and I thought if I could get out of there in 4 years with an undergraduate business degree, that would be a plus. Graduated Babson in 82. Again, my grades were not that good. I worked part-time with a broker at Merrill Lynch. I used to ride my bike on into Beacon Street and work there. That was during the great silver fiasco with Bunker Hunt and things like that. One semester, we were talking last night, one semester I had pneumonia, and everyone said I should just take a semester off, but I couldn't afford to take the semester off. So I went to all my teachers and said I have pneumonia and I collapsed a lung, but I'm not going to give up and I'm not going to take a semester off. I'm just going to fight through the best I can. They said, your grades aren't going to be that good. I said, I never care about grades. So I think that semester I got one C and three Ds, and it didn't look good on my transcript when I got a job, but I ended up getting a stock market job at the Northern Trust in Chicago in 1982. That's where I started, June of 82. The market was horrible, horrible. But they took a shot on me. I made $17,000 my first year there. And I recall I was so bullish I couldn't even stand it. They weren't bullish. I was bullish. Market ended up taking off three, four months later. In June of 85, I met David Rocker through a mutual friend. David was just starting a fund, had $20 million, decided to move to New York with my then wife, subsequently been divorced, and that was the start of Rocker Partners. Rocker Partners turned into Copper River. Son was born in 87 with cerebral palsy. and the best therapy that was available was on the West Coast in Marin County. So I told David, moving to Marin. He said, fine, you can work there. And been in California ever since. Fund closed in 2008, 2009. I'm sure everyone knows that sordid tale. And took a couple years off and sort of couldn't help myself because I'm addicted to this garbage. And sort of back at it. So that is the very quick and very dirty.
So, Mark, how did you know that you wanted to be in investing? You started down that path early in your career, but as you said, came from a bit of a non-traditional background. You weren't the Harvard, Yale, top of your class type of guy. What attracted you, and how did you really know that was the thing that you should dedicate your life to?
That's a good question. So in high school, I just was interested in everything other than schoolwork. And I remember there was the World Football League and the Chicago team folded. And I said, hell, maybe this stuff's worth something one day. So I bought all of the Chicago team's jerseys. I think at the time it was like $1,600. I bought all of them. And it was every cent I had. And I sold the stuff online through something called Sports Collectors Digest. And I think I turned $1,600 into about $16,000, which was an awful lot of money in 76, 77, something like that. And then I parlayed that into trading gold. I've always sort of somewhat been interested in gold. So I traded call options in ASA. I mean, I shouldn't have, because first of all, you got to be 18, but I got some guy to open up an account for me. So I traded gold, stocks, call options, and ASA for a bit and sort of got the investment bug, and I enjoyed it. And I sort of parlayed that into a fair, you know, 30, 40 grand by the time I went to college. And I wanted to go to a business school and I wanted to focus on investments, and I thought it would be a great thing. And midway through college, I think my sophomore, junior year, after I got better from the pneumonia, I thought a stock was really cheap called Data Access Systems. And it turned out, I put a ton of my money in the thing, and it turned out to be a complete fraud. So I think I then lost 70% of my money on that. And that taught me a valuable lesson that this is a sophisticated game. And I was going about my business very willy-nilly, even though I was young. And no one knew how much money I had, including my parents. And I said, if I'm going to make a career out of this, or I'm going to be serious in this, I better know what the hell I'm doing.
So, Mark, we're going to talk about all the big hits, Overstock and MyMedics and Camping World, all of your favorite names. But before we dive deep into any of the specifics, I've heard you say many times that there's only so many types of fraud. And I think it would be interesting for our audience to hear from you, because I'm assuming that the lifelong passion for discovering, uncovering, and ultimately shorting frauds probably derives from that original incident where you lost a lot of money. The best way to learn how to make money is to lose some. What are the sort of the typical types of fraud that you would look for, red flags that hit your radar? There's only so many of them. Maybe you could walk us through a couple of them.
That's a good question. And as you said, with the losing money, I told a story again last night at dinner that when my daughter graduated the eighth grade, the class got to vote on who they wanted to speak at commencement. And they voted for me because they used to go on field trips and stuff like that, which was a great time because I like kids. And the head of the trustees calls me up and says, what do you plan on talking about on your commencement speech? I said, well, I'm going to speak on failure, how it's good to fail, how if you don't fail and fail big and fail early and young in life, it's not a good thing. Don't be afraid to fail. So they heard this and they called me back in 2 days and said, congratulations, you won, but we're going to go in a different direction and someone else is going to speak. So when you said the best way to make money is learn how to lose money and learn from your mistakes, you got to learn. I'm not the sharpest knife in the drawer, but no one will outwork me. No one will out-hustle me. No one will outthink me. No one will out-perceive me. No one will. But when I was done in on the data access fraud, it was a channel stuffing fraud, which is one fraud. And then there's various forms of accounting where, you know, you can ship bricks like MiniScribe and claim you have business when it doesn't exist. MediaVision did that. There's LearnOut and HouseBee simply booked revenue at a related party, whether it was the Brussels Translation Group or Dictation Consortium. And then after they did that, they acquired them, wrote down the receivables, and kept parlaying that. Serial acquisition accounting tends to be very fraud-ridden. Accounting in terms of pulling it over on an auditor is very, very easy to do because the auditor never checks for fraud. And on a MyMedics, where, I mean, that is a massive fraud. It's a massive fraud that's ongoing today. They covered it on many angles, including selling the same item more than once. That's yet to even come out. And they did that through tissue tagging. They did that through consignment at the VA. They did that through, you know, fake receivables, which they still haven't reconciled. And you have a wire card fraud, which is really a money laundering operation. And as you were talking about with donut shorts and round tripping, they went and used cash to acquire garbage and then ran that back through as revenue and profits. So I'm very weak or very bad with insurance company fraud, which is very complex stuff. So that's not really my cup of tea. I'm familiar with mortgage fraud with Novastar, how they played with gain on sale assumptions in their subprime mortgages to overstate earnings. And they use those overstated earnings to pay a dividend that they never earned. There's mark-to-market fraud that was American Capital Strategies, an ally back in the day. Einhorn wrote a really good book on that. So there's different types of it, but by and large right now, no one really cares. And it's sort of sad that no one cares, but we're in a crime pays environment. So I think I said on the Real Vision thing that I did with Grant a few times that MyMedics was my last rodeo. Got a little embroiled in the wire card thing, but MyMedics was the last rodeo just because it's so goddamn hard and it's so dangerous. And there's so much money involved now with it. There's so much money involved in perpetrating it that it's downright dangerous. And law enforcement doesn't know what the hell to do. And they care more about doing nothing and quieting skeptics rather than getting to the truth. So, you know, in a lot of ways, I'm lucky to be in one piece. I've really enjoyed what I've done over the years. I think my track record speaks for itself. I don't think anyone on the planet times six has exposed more chicanery than I have. And I take great pride in it because behind all of it, I think I've saved a lot of people's lives through their healthcare fraud or bankrupting people, both in the United States and Canada. And I've stopped people from doing really bad stuff and really screwing individuals out of their hard-earned money by exposing some of this stuff and being public at it. So I'm very pleased with what I've done over a very long period of time.
Mark, each one of the companies that you focused on, it's really been a marathon to chase them down, and takes a long period of time of dedication and resolve. Share with us a bit of your process. So when you get a sense that there's a company that deserves your attention, where there is some manipulation going on and evidence of fraud, what do the next, 6 to 12 months look like? How do you dive in? How do you proceed? Do you have a media strategy? I assume you must have some sort of legal strategy. I don't know that I've heard of a single investor being sued as many times as you have. How do you put all the pieces together, kind of line them up and knock them down?
That's a good question. Yeah, I was looking at my legal bills this year, just way too high. But Guy Gentile is going to owe me $300,000 to $400,000. So that'll take a bite off of that. So as I like to say in a non-pervy way, I view myself as a stalker. I stalk my prey from miles and years away. I use this, I never climb the tree to chase the jaguar. I wait for someone to shoot the jaguar out of the tree. And when the thing's lying on the ground all busted up, I'll then take a knife and carve the thing up in fine fashion. So there's probably in my head, in my mind, I'm probably aware of maybe 300 to 400 names, probably across 5 to 6 industries that I'm just watching, in the back of my mind, just observing what's going on. Then I think when the time's right and there's bad news, or someone shoots the jaguar out of the tree, we should get into that a little bit. Then I'll pounce in and get involved. But if you're early, you're wrong. And part of what's really wrong in the short community now is you have a lot of Johnny come latelys, and you have a lot of guys who think they're professionals, but they're not. They're more marketing machines. And what they do is they take a position on a Monday, write something up on a Tuesday, they cover it Tuesday afternoon, and that's that. This is hard work. This is time consuming. This is labor intensive. And you have to, in your mind, write the final chapter of what the newspaper article looks like when this thing blows up, or see what the end game is. And none of these bad companies ever give up, right? They don't give a hoot about some guy writing a blog about a Chinese fraud and this, that, and the other. You may be right, but they're not going to come out of the building with their hands in the air. And they figure, we'll just keep putting out some positive PR and saying your thing's false and just go on with our day, which then creates a squeeze. And then something starts going up. All the people who piled in pile out. No, that's not for me. You have to figure out what the end of the game looks like and say, how can I affect this and how can I make this happen? And, MyMedics is a perfect example. I was dragged into the MyMedics fight. Probably the dumbest thing that Parker Petit, who stands trial in October, ever did, dragging me in. But he dragged me in. I didn't even know what the hell this thing did. But he called me names. He said I launder money for a drug cartel and this, that, and the other. And so Carson called me and said, are you aware of what Parker Petit or Pete Petit saying about you? I said, no. He pointed me in the direction, and he was calling me a money launderer and a naked shorter and all this. And I said, boy, if this guy wants to drag me into this, I better figure out what the hell a MyMedics actually is or what a MyMedics does. And, from then on, it's been well documented a little bit about MyMedics, but he starts hyping the stock, Pete does. And I don't know, it's kind of November-ish of 17, and I create this website, PetiteParkerTheBarker.com, which is still up and I'm still posting on it. And I know I'm getting to them, and I'm getting to them in a big way. And then we had the famed, you know, FBI visit in December. And stock keeps going up. And I said to myself, this just isn't going to stop. And if he's sending the FBI my way to shut me up, I have to do something. And that's when I showed up at JP Morgan in mid-January and created that dust up calling him out. And that was really when the tide changed, because shortly after that, I wrote a very lengthy letter to the auditor, Ian Y, happens to be Wirecard's auditor as well. And from then on, it was very downhill for MiMedx and very downhill for Pete. And I have this saying, you know, I never let go of the rope. When I think I have you, I do not let go of the rope, which means I will not give up. I will not give up, and I will not stop. I will not. And I said, I have to take matters into my own hands and make this happen. Otherwise, he's going to sell this piece of shit to somebody, you know, a la what some of these fraudsters do. Their last bastion of escapism is try to sell the made-up company with the made-up numbers to someone who doesn't do due diligence, and I'm going to lose, and I don't want to lose here. I never like to lose. I hate to lose. Losing is worse to me than winning. I mean, as good as winning feels, I hate to lose. I hate it. I hate it. And I especially hate losing to a fraudster. Can't stand it. It's awful. And I was not going to lose to this guy. I was not. So I had to make something happen. And so it's not a... wasn't a legal strategy. He never sued me, because if he sued me, I had all the goods on him, and it would have backfired on him worse than it's already has. It's not a marketing strategy. I'm a one-man marketing machine. I don't have a PR firm. I have my Twitter, which is at Alderland Eggs. But I speak my mind. I don't have any aliases, and I don't have any troll accounts. It's just little old me. But I will take that rope and wrap it around someone's throat and hook them up to a pickup truck and drag them for 100 miles if I have to, because I will not give up when I think I have you. I will not give up. And if people have not learned that by now, I think they're going to learn it very shortly. But that's a long way around answering that question. But does that make some form of sense?
Certainly does. I took a note, stay on Mark's good side.
yes, let's host that around the yeah. office.
The thing I want to dive a little deeper on is this FBI visit, which is pretty remarkable. And history has since taught us that it appears that Parker Petite called the good senator from Georgia, Johnny Isaacson, and Johnny Isaacson called in a favor from the FBI. And the FBI shows up at your place to basically tell you to stop tweeting about Parker Petite. It's almost surreal that that could happen in America in this day and age. Why don't you tell us what the latest is on that, if there's anything that's developed? I mean, stunning to me that that could happen, and there's basically, as far as I can tell, been no consequence yet.
There's been no consequence. Highlight the word yet. What we have is we have made all sorts of FOIA requests to the FBI, the DOJ, everyone, and we have some highly redacted stuff back that Isaacson made significant calls to the FBI, who, it's unclear, on behalf of Parker Petite, to simply shut me up. This concept that the trolls and people loyal to Pete were saying were death threats were completely bogus. And that's just not the case. But they tried to do that to discredit me. We've complied with all FOIAs, FOIA appeals, this, that, and the other, and the FBI and DOJ just will not turn anything over. They say information exists and we'll get it to you between 4 months and 4 years. And my lawyer is a former U.S. attorney. I have two lawyers. I actually have three. I have two in the U.S. and one in Canada. My lawyer said this is bullshit, and right now we're suing the FBI and the DOJ in federal court in San Francisco to get all the FOIA information about this. I think it is a deathly serious matter. And I think I said to you at the time how serious it is, because all Pete had to pay Isaacson, best we can tell, is $15,000. And if you can pay a senator $15,000 to get the FBI to be your personal police, to shut up a skeptic, we are in bigger trouble than anyone thinks we're already in. So the backstory with Isaacson is Chris Ray, who was a lawyer at King & Spalding, a partner at King & Spalding, who's now the director of the FBI, and King & Spalding's an Atlanta firm. We have Chris Ray donating significant sums to Johnny Isaacson's reelection campaign, I think, three times. So if, and that is a big if, it turns out that Chris Ray was involved, or Isaacson was playing footsie with Christopher Ray, who's the director of the FBI, and Christopher Ray ordered the code red, or whatever happened, I think then that will be front page news, and that will be a huge story. And then I think heads will roll in a big, big, big way. Because this precedent, someone needs to lean up against it, otherwise people are going to get seriously hurt and or killed, because this is getting absolutely beyond crazy. And you know, I don't have a firm. I just manage my own money and my son's money. My wife is too jittery to invest for her. And you know, someone has to do something. And the media has its own bent. And this free speech, I always say free speech is only free if it's bullish. Boy, if there's ever a time for that, it's now. I mean, that's been proven correct. But between the Wirecard intimidation and what they spent, which was a small sum of money, they've subsequently said, you know, including hacking and things like that, and what my medics did, you know, people should be outraged and people should be mortified. And you know, one of the things that's very important, and that every listener to this and every market participant or really civilian needs to understand, is if it happens to you, it's a serious matter. I get that, right? I get it. You know, if you get COVID or your loved one gets COVID and you die, it's a serious matter. But no one else pays attention. Everyone else thinks it's just not, it's doesn't happen at home, so it's no big deal. Well, if it happens to me, it can happen to you, and it could happen to Babushka, who Musk went after. And if Wirecard could threaten and sue the Financial Times, it could happen to the Wall Street Journal, it could happen to Reuters, it could happen to Handelsblatt, it could happen to you. So until people start to push back against the man and all this horrifically bad behavior, and it's just not, you know, a sideshow or fun and games, or he deserved that because he's a loudmouth, or he threatened to kill him, or this, that, and the other. That's just all bull. It's all a disguise to shut up people who try to make a difference, who try to move the needle, who try to expose fraud, who try to help promote good and stop bad. It is good versus evil. But the problem is no one knows the bad guys anymore. I used to have great respect for the FBI. I used to have great respect for the police. I'm a law and order guy. But what's gone on, and as it relates to me, is horrific. And I'm not, you know, I'm not asking anyone to have a tag day for me or feel sorry for me. What they should do is fight against the system and raise their hand and say, you know, this is effed up. I mean, I would use, you told me to keep it clean, so I'm keeping it clean. But this is, you know, these are very bad precedents that are being sent. And I'm just basically putting my hands in the air and saying, I'm a 60-year-old man, have a lovely wife, great life, I have plenty of money, I take care of a 33-year-old disabled man. I don't need to end up dead. I don't need to end up dead from all this BS, or tracked down or threatened or this, that, and the other. It's no way to go through life. I mean, I have, you know, Guy Gentile is all over Twitter and his board saying he can't wait to pump and dump my wife, you know, and he's going to short overstock down to a dollar. I don't deserve any of that. And that spawns crazy talk, and it spawns crazy behavior. And, you know, where are the feds to shut any of this crap down? They don't. So, you know, I kind of after a while just sort of say uncle to some of them. Is that too long-winded for the FBI answer?
No. And I, as you can imagine, I can sympathize. The intensity of the trolling and the outright falsities that are spread about an individual when they become critical of somebody powerful is really, really a remarkable thing. Let's pivot to Wirecard. You mentioned that they basically did the same thing. They co-opted the police state of Germany to go after skeptics and critics and even newspaper reporters. You had a role in Wirecard. You were on it for a few years. You were certainly short the name shortly after it collapsed. Talk us through your history with Wirecard and the sort of analogies that you see with MyMedics.
Well, the thing with Wirecard is, you know, I'm really good pals with John Hempton. I think Hempton is great, and I've known him forever. And when he was fighting this thing back in the day, I don't know if it was 2000, I mean, it goes back so long. He, you know, told me, and I think has told others, it's the biggest loss he's ever taken in his life, both personally and in his fund. It was just a horrifically bad name. And I read all the Zatara stuff, and that's, you know, I met Frazier after Zatara folded, and I thought their work on Wirecard was outstanding, but now, that's when the stock was 30 on its way to 200 and some odd, and I looked at this thing and I just said, this thing is nuts, and I'm staying way, way, way away. I mean, why in the world would I ever want to get involved in this? It looks like it's the money laundering arm of the German government, which I think, you know, in retrospect, I think that's exactly what it is. And I stayed away, and there were some wonderful people, some brilliant young minds doing tremendous research on this thing. And I think the untold story of Wirecard is the research the Duhamel's crew did on it, Slate Path, Fahmy did a ton of work on this, the Zatara guys did a ton of work. I mean, there's a lot of young up-and-comers. They did tremendous, tremendous research on Wirecard. I didn't do any research on Wirecard. I saw what was out there and said, at some point in time, you know, me being the stalker I am, I'll be involved in this thing. And shortly after, you know, some of McCrum's pieces came out, they sued Financial Times, got the Financial Times investigated, short sale ban, this, that, and the other. And after being hassled by the FBI, you know, I think I have some belt of this PTSD. I did a Periscope, and I, you know, I play it back every now and then. You know, it looked like I was so upset my voice was cracking. And I said, you know, if you guys at Wirecard are going after McCrum, who I like and respect and I think does an outstanding job, if you're going after him the way you are, and Handelsblatt and the Journal, and Bloomberg and Reuters all sit there and do nothing. They do nothing to defend this guy or say what's going on is wrong. You know, now you guys have me in the fight. Okay, now I'm in. And people said they're going to hack you, they're going to do this, that, and the other. And sure enough, you know, they hacked me as part of their grand conspiracy. And, you know, more on that a little later. And I just said, I really don't care. And I took what was out there, made it simpler. Because sometimes when people get involved in names, the details get so granular, you can't really tell a story. It gets very, very, very complex and convoluted and ununderstandable that, you know, people just don't get it. So I think I helped move a needle. I wasn't the needle mover by any way, shape, or form. But I encouraged others and other media operations to look at this thing simply through a much clearer lens of what was going on, which is very simply a huge money laundering operation worldwide wrapped in an accounting fraud. I mean, people, I'm not going to get into names because I don't need to pick fights with any more than I already have going on. But to say they approach this as an accounting fraud is very simplistic and doesn't do what's going on here the proper service. The Germans and the German government and the people who've enabled Wirecard would love this to be a simple accounting fraud. They'd love nothing more than that, because that would mean the money laundering and all the criminality that's going on from kiddie porn to arms dealership to these cash MasterCard prepaid cards to all this bullshit. It means that stuff, they get away with it and it gets swept under the rug, which would be a terrible, terrible, terrible thing. I mean, women have been attacked here and beat up. People have been beat up. Offices have been vandalized. Wirecard has hacked my stuff and others and have sold it off to enemies of people. There's some bad, bad, bad stuff that went on. And to say, oh, it's just a simple accounting fraud and this, that, and the other, and it was so obvious, just does a huge, huge, huge disservice to what went on, what goes on, and what is yet to be uncovered. I mean, I think that the story, if I were to guess, that's yet to be told, that's going to come out, is how MasterCard, symbol MA, you know, enabled a whole lot of this through their high-risk department. And I think there's a fellow with the last name Pellucci. I think he's going to have some. He needs to answer some serious questions because this is his venue. I don't know much here, but I'm speculating, you know, because a lot of prepaid MasterCard, Wirecard cards have been floating around. And I think MasterCard has made an absolute fortune from this thing. I mean, there's a lot of money in selling drugs. There's a lot of money in selling heroin to kids. It's a hugely profitable business. If it was a stock, it should trade at 2x earnings, because you could be blown away at the street corner one day and all of a sudden you have no business, or you can be arrested and be in jail for 50 years and you'll have no business. But crime is a big business, and crime is hugely profitable, which is what Wirecard was. And it's amazing how when the Wirecard story, the story of exactly what has come out on Marsalac, and Braun, and all this stuff. It's come out now. It's amazing how many of these journalists had it 3, 4, 5, 8 months ago, and they all did nothing. They all did nothing other than the Financial Times and a few newspapers in Germany. A few. But this was allowed to go on and on and on and on. And as long as they kept the stock up, no one really cared until it collapsed. And I was short Wirecard. I said I was short Wirecard during the Periscope. But where the money was to be made at Wirecard was I was, thank God, able to borrow more as the thing broke and just kept doing it. Did it in the 20s. I did it in the 60s. I did it in the 40s. I did it in the teens. I just didn't care. And that's just the classic jaguar in the tree. And the jaguar was shot out of the tree once and for all when the auditor said they couldn't verify the missing $1.9 billion, which was always the elephant in the room. And once that happened, it was over. So it's not that you cover it because it's down 50%. Or you cover it because it's down 80%. You just say, this business is a massive fraud and the thing is just completely worthless because it's a criminal operation. And you have to be patient when you stalk these things, especially guys who are tied into governments. Because no one in this day and age walks out of the building, put their hands in the air and says, yep, Shorts, you got me, right? You're just bang on. You have it. They put up a fight. They send out misinformation. They'll hire trolls, this, that, and the other. And, you know, Wirecard and the money they paid both hacking people's emails and the troll army, you know, they're much, much, much fewer troll armies now that Wirecard has sort of been put to rest. All that money that's been used to hassle the skeptics and hassle their critics and hassle the freedom fighters, all that has miraculously stopped with Wirecard meeting its maker. And it's not a coincidence. It's not a coincidence. So that's my thing with Wirecard, and I think it's very important to give proper credit on names to individuals. You know, a lot of money managers are way past their expiration date, and in order for the good of the industry, young people need to be recognized as rising stars and people who do the right thing for the so-called love of the game that I have. Because otherwise, it's just, you know, new trees aren't going to be able to grow. And tired people are going to take other people's ideas and claim credit. And I just think it's horrifically wrong. And I'm a big believer in doing your own work, standing up for what you believe in, and having the courage of your convictions. And I'd like to see young people prosper and do well in this business. And in, you know, I'm 60. I've been doing this, you know, professionally since I was 21. And you know, what I'm most proud of is me being a good dad, trying to be a good dad, and two, the longevity that I've had over the decades of this bullshit that's gone on and help and expose bullshit. And I'd like to see people, you know, try to do this going forward. So
you highlighted something as it relates to Wirecard that I think is quite insightful and important to spend a moment on, and that's the role of the regulatory bodies, and that if we focus purely on the accounting fraud in the Wirecard story, that it does a great disservice to some of these bigger components at play, which have much larger implications. You've talked about it with Germany, here with Wirecard. I know you've spent quite a bit of your career looking at frauds in Canada, where the regulatory environment may make that a more permissive place to conduct fraud. What are your views of what is happening in the U.S.? You know, within the FinTwit community, we spend a lot of time looking at some of the actions taken or not taken by the SEC. And I wonder, is it that things are, in fact, becoming far more concerning and lax in the U.S., or does it just seem that way because we're so focused on it?
Well, the U.S., as bad as it feels, I would say it's worse than that. It's actually worse than that, I think. I could break it down simply. I think the death of the SEC was the date of, again, I'm not a Tesla guy and don't really want to get into it, but the date of the 60 Minutes with Elon Musk, when he looked into the camera and says, I don't respect the SEC, you know, the SEC is this, that, and the other. I mean, the SEC fined Elon, I think, $20 million, and I think on paper he's made, I don't know, maybe $3 or $4 billion since. I don't know what he's made. And I think the stock's up at least, you know, 1,200 points, whatever he owns. It's probably $3 billion. And then he's gotten his bonus. So he pays $20 million and he's $3 billion to the good. Chairman of the board of Tesla, I think, has made $220 million. So, you know, who wouldn't sign up for that? So he basically, Elon basically put an axe in the forehead of the SEC, and Jay Clayton has aspirations, you know, to do something other than run the SEC. And I think when people see that and say he can get away with this, and they can get away with it in Canada, and they can get away with it in Germany, and we can trade on the inside on Kodak, and we can front run, Citadel can front run trades and do this, that, and the other. Obviously, the government is just looking the other way because the guy who sits on top of the government needs to get reelected. And the only thing he really has going for himself is the stock market. And I've said this, you know, for the past 18 months. And so I think things are just an absolute disaster. Free markets aren't free. They're, you know, crime has paid, and people who've done really bad things aren't brought to justice. So how it all shakes out, I mean, we're on a very, very, very slippery slope. The good people I know at the SEC, a lot of them have left. A lot of them defend bad guys. And the people who are there, they're probably so overworked, they're outmatched, they're outgunned. And you know, any skeptical story that begins with the SEC is going to do something is, you know, it's probably a better long than a short, because if your short thesis or your skeptical thesis relies on the SEC or really the government getting involved, I think you have a really big problem. And since I'm a generational player, I remember when the SEC was relevant. I remember when the SEC would show up at a company and people would say, this is really bad news. You know, now they're just kind of sort of sloughed off. It's more of like a, you know, a traffic cop. You know, it's just, so what? I mean, no one really cares. And the granddaddy of them all with the funding secured guy, you know, he, you know, to his credit, he's an aggressive guy. Elon is, and he just doesn't give a rat's ass about anyone other than him. And he's able to run, he's able to measure regulatory, and he says, I'm the guy. You know, I am the guy. I'm enabled. I have plenty of money. I have great lawyers, and I'm going to do whatever the hell I want to do. And I dare you to stop me. And he's destroyed every skeptic there is. He's destroyed, you know, oversight agencies. He's destroyed them. Now, how it all shakes out, who the hell knows? But, you know, I've always said, you know, I want nothing to do with this thing. I will wait till the jaguar's out of the tree, which may be 10, 15, 20 years, 5 years from now. But, you know, everyone, you know, who wants to say Tesla is worth GM plus Ford plus Toyota plus BMW plus whatever. You know, you're just kidding yourselves. Because I can go back 8 years when people would say, can you believe Tesla's worth GM? And I can go back 10 years when the same yabberers were preaching the Tesla short story at 100. And now it's worth 1,500, 1,400, 1,300. Just doesn't even matter. It's just kind of move on to something else. I mean, that war is not going to be won anytime soon unless something drastically changes. So regulatory-wise, until there's regime change at the top, you know, whether it's whoever the Democrats elect or, you know, when Trump terms out, I don't see how there's a change. I don't see what's going to change it. I mean, hell, Germany is defending themselves in Wirecard. Canada has the Ministry of Finance and this great charity scandal. I mean, there's so many frauds in Canada. There's the question is finding what's legitimate up there. So, but again, you know, I'm just one guy with an opinion, and I'm happy I'm in one piece and this, that, and the other. And, you know, I said what on my Twitter on March 16th, it's the first, or March 18th, it's the first time in 11 years I'm actually long. I'm not long and I'm bullish because, you know, you could sort of see what was coming.
Yeah.
So
Mark, one minor correction. He's up about $40 billion in net worth since he said, I do not respect the SEC.
Order of magnitude. Okay.
More. He's up $4 billion since he instructed Jay Clayton to fillet him.
I mean,
can you believe the CEO goes on Twitter and tells the SEC to perform oral sex on him? And nothing happens. It's just really amazing.
Well, I mean, it's just the whole thing where the guy is a master, and you have to give him credit. Is a couple of those hitches along the way. He would say, "What I think my stock's overpriced" or something like that.
Yeah, laying the groundwork for future defense.
Right. Yeah, I mean, it's just right. I mean, at 700, I think the stock's drastically overpriced, and it goes down 50 points and traps more people in, and there we have it. But hats off to him, to the victor goes the spoils, and he sets up the template for others to follow, sadly.
So you said something, let's pivot away from Tesla because it's giving me a headache. I'm kidding, of course. You said for the first time you're net long. Let's end the show on a couple of your longs. We have a lot to unpack with the overstock story. You've been loud and proud, long overstock. It flied higher after you announced your position. And then what I'm really curious about is at the low. So Patrick Byrne skips the country. Looks like he pulled off a pump and dump. All of your critics and trolls are shoving it in your face. The stock is in the single digits. Walk us through those moments. What were you thinking? What do you say? They'd say, oh, you got saved by COVID. Overstock has been a controversial name for you, as controversial as any of your shorts. Walk us through, that whole history.
Well, I'm going to leave alone the history when I was short overstock, because then it just starts getting too confusing. But in one week, I will have been long overstock for 3 years. I started buying overstock in August of 17, somewhere between $13 and $16. And at Grant's, which was in October, I made my go long overstock pitch. And the big part of my pitch was they had all these blockchain assets, which I believe in thoroughly to this day, and those assets are doing better. But I said the crown jewel is retail and the dot-com business. And the dot-com business at the time was selling at 0.2 or 0.3 times sales. And I said, with Wayfair selling at 1.5 times sales and Amazon at this and all these other things at this, this overstock is drastically undervalued. Well, I like Patrick. I do. I respect Patrick. I think I know Patrick pretty well. I've been on all sides of Patrick. I was against Patrick. I was short Patrick because I thought he was out of control. I got behind Patrick because I thought he amended his ways and put together a really good company with exciting assets. And I really thought Patrick had changed. I really did. And Patrick is a genius, and he's a brilliant man. He's also very troubled, and he's also somewhere on the spectrum, like a lot of very brilliant people. And my wish and desire was for him to be able to pull it off. But he wasn't able to. I think he let his demons get the best of him. You know, with the Russian and the spy and this, that, and the other. And when some of that crazy stuff started to happen, I communicated with the board in a very quiet way that I didn't publicize that Patrick needed to go. That it was becoming about Patrick and not about the company. And that there was a lack of focus. And that for the good of the company, that message needed to change. And they got rid of Patrick. And I'm very proud to say I had a big hand in that. Big hand. And the fellow they brought in, Johnson, I've known for a very long time. And he's not flashy. He's very smart. But he's an execution, no bullshit guy. He doesn't, I'm just going to say it for the first time, he doesn't fuck around. And he got rid of Patrick's guys, and he brought in his guys. And the home category that they're in, when properly managed, does well. And Overstock was doing much better in search. They were doing much better in business prior to the virus. And at the same time all this was going on, I had an unrelenting bunch of haters who miraculously have all disappeared, the cowards and criminals they are. And they've all disappeared. They won't apologize. They won't say they're wrong. The stock's only gone from 3 to 70, right, this year. 3 to 70. That's pretty decent. You'd think one of them would say, well done. You'd think one of them would say, you were kind of right here and we were kind of wrong. No. They just, with all their bullshit, all their hate, all their threats to my family, threats to my son, threats to my wife, right? All this hate, it's just about a stock, and I hit it out of the goddamn park, right? I hit it out of the park, and instead of, I don't need any more than I've gotten, but it would sure be interesting if some of these haters and naysayers would come around and say, we were really wrong. And where these trolls and all these anti-Twitter people, what people don't understand is a lot of people, on Twitter hear things and this, that, and the other, and they take it and they run with it. And these guys can panic people out of stocks. And they scared innocent people out of this thing at a very low number. And it cost people a lot of money. And that's very unfortunate because I can't fight every fight. I can't answer every bit of criticism. I have 11,400 people blocked on Twitter because I cannot deal with noise. I try to focus and I try to get it right. And when Patrick Byrne, to get back to your thing, got out of focus and focused on the Russian, slept with the Russian, this story, conspiracy thing, it got away from Overstock. It got away from the focus of the business. It got in the way of what the company needed to do. And unlike all these loudmouth activists, I got it done behind the scenes without creating a stir, without creating a stink, and without creating a brouhaha. Just did it Saddam Hussein style, walking up from behind someone and blowing their brains out when they didn't even know. And that's that. And the best thing that happened to the company is Patrick Byrne moved on. I mean, he sold his stock at 19 on its way to 3 or 4, let everyone high and dry. And I think I've spent conservatively, the last I don't know, 16 months, I probably spent 4 hours a day on overstock or overstock related, you know, things like that. You know, there's a guy, Brad Safflow of PAA Research, who's really, really good. He's done some brilliant work on it, Tom Forte Davidson. And the great thing about overstock this year, stock started the year at 7. This ass hat Joe Nocera's hassling me on a whole ton of things, including that. The stock's now 70, so I guess that's up 10 times, right? And, you know, the incredible thing is there's one guy following it who recommends it, D.A. Davidson. And CNBC, which I call the Cartoon Network, never as much mentions it. They never mention it, which is just outstanding, which just shows you don't need hype or their PR or all their bullshit to make something work or something be good. So, you know, I wish Patrick well. I hope he's healthy. I have great respect for him. He's a 3-time cancer survivor. But, you know, he has demons that he needs to work on and control. And you know, I know the many sides of Patrick, and you know, I can't stand drama, and I'm glad the drama's over, and I'm glad the company's doing really well. They reported outstanding numbers today, and the stock was up, at least when we started this deal. And I'm very happy. But I'm really happy for the people who listened to me and who believed in what I had to say and who stuck it out. Because I know at one point those people were way down, and my buddies at Collective Soul, they were all long the stock. And literally at the end of last year, you know, Max and I saw him on the East Coast and the stock was low. I literally, when I was around those guys, couldn't eat. And I'm an eater because I was so sick to my stomach because I viewed I cost these guys so much money. And I take, you know, I take everything in this business. I take it personally. And when people say you shouldn't take it personally, it's only stocks. See, that's 100% wrong. If you're managing other people's money, or you're in the, you give, you publicly say things, you better take it personally, because you're talking about something serious here, and that is other people's money. And I'm just thrilled that this overstock monkey is off my back. It feels really good. And you know what? I don't really care that much about the money. You know, I've made a lot of money. I've lost a lot of money. I got plenty of money. I'm just happy people who believed in me and believed in the story did well. You know, did well. So just makes me happy.
It's interesting because so much of the hype around overstock, in addition to, you know, Patrick Byrne and some of, you know, people's kind of interest and intrigue with what he was up to and what he was doing, so much of the interest is around T0 and they're playing crypto. And yet I look at the press release, you know, that came out for the most recent earnings, and so much of the success there is related to the core business, related to retail sales, you know, sales of home furnishings. What is the strategy under Johnson, and are you still bullish on the name, or is it starting to reflect the value that you were expecting all along?
So I've sold a good chunk of my overstock stock, that symbol OSTK, and I've put it all, that's capital ALL, in the overstock preferred that trades on T0, it's symbol OSTKO. Trades at about a 40% discount to the common. In my mind, OSTKO is worth more than the common. It's peri, you get one share of common in the overstock preferred, plus you get a dividend. And the dividend's yet to be declared. And I think I have a handle that the dividend may be far greater than anyone can even guess when they declare it. And I think when the smoke clears between now and the end of the year, the OSTKO is going to be trading higher than OSTK. So I love the situation very much. If overstock 70 and OSTKO is 45 to 50, I think you can bend over at the waist and pick up $20 to $25 just if these things trade the same. People would argue that OSTKO is illiquid. I don't really care. Liquidity will find this thing when the smoke clears. T0, in my mind, is going to be a grand slam in the future. I'm very, very, very bullish on T0, which is a huge overstock investment. T0 is essentially going to be an exchange for digital securities or security tokens. And I think that if people see what's going on with SPACs right now, right, how these companies are able to go public in this SPAC fashion, these so-called blank check entities, why wouldn't they just come out and tokenize and trade that way? Why wouldn't they just trade on the platform? And T0 is an exchange. And they said on the call this morning that T0 is looking at doing a raise or something like that. And this is after the CEO foregone or gave up 60% of his salary, and he's taken it in the place of stock comp, which I think is hugely bullish. And it wouldn't surprise me if T0 partners up with a Wall Street firm and pushes that digital platform more mainstream, and then the thing will be worth, T0 will be worth billions, because it'll have an exchange. And I think the wave of the future is going to be digital securities away from how things currently go. And that would be same-day settlement. It would be everyone has their own special security. It would be on a ledger. Everyone would know, companies would know who's in these things. And there would be a whole lot less riffraff going on. So I think it's the future. I think there'll be other guys doing it, but I think T0 will have a seat at the table. So I like T0, which is part of the overstock thing. I like votes, which is blockchain voting, which I think if there's ever a time for something like that, it's now. I think their retail business is very strong. I think Johnson's a focused guy. He is not flashy. And I like block and tackling execution guys. Stock is followed by one person. I think that's going to change. Company has a ton of cash. The haters and the trolls said they would be bankrupt by January. That's false. They have $300 million of cash. Wouldn't surprise me they raise some more. So I like this thing a lot, but I've moved a lot of my OSTK holdings into OSTKO. And that's that. OSTKO and Camping World are my big ones from here for a while.
It's nice to see that you're just as passionate on the long side as you are on the short side. And it's probably a good time to remind the audience that none of this is investment advice, and please do your own research. And Mark has done the work and has put his money where his work was spent, and you should do the same before you pull the trigger on any investments based on anything you hear from anybody, frankly, but especially on this show. Before we move to Camping World, which is where I'd like to close, I do want to address one topic that's out there that caused you a lot of, I would say, not, you know, good, got the trolls riled up. When you made a donation to Roddy Boyd, who we'd had on the show, Roddy is a great guest. He did a lot of really excellent work in Wirecard. At one point in the overstock journey, you had made a donation to his nonprofit, and then you were sort of blasted all over Twitter by people claiming that you had sold overstock at the top, and it was a pump and dump, and so on and so on. Can you give the full background on that, just to clear it up once and for all here on our show?
Yeah, totally. So I have cash, but you know, you're incented by the government to donate stock, cars, boats, all sorts of like items. And I have great respect for Roddy. I don't agree with everything he writes. I don't agree with everything he says. But I've known Roddy for a very long time, and I got respect for his work. He's a God-fearing man. He's far more religious than me. I'm not religious at all. I don't believe in that stuff, but that's fine. I donated to SURF lightly over the years, and I knew his fundraising efforts were not going particularly well. So I was talking to him about making a donation that year, because that was a really good year for me, because Overstock was way the hell up, way up, and I made a lot on Overstock. So I said to Roddy, how much does it cost you to run your operation a year? You know, he said plus or minus 100 grand, something like that. And I was thinking, you know, if I gift him Overstock stock, 5 grand, which was a small fraction of what I owned at the time, A, I'd keep this guy in business, keep him around, and I think it's important that he be around for the markets, and because he's one of the few free speakers not captured that there are, and I thought it would be a good thing to do. I said, run it by your guys, run it by your board and the whole thing, which he did. He said, yep, it would be fine. So I donated him 5,000 shares of stock. Most guys, when they make a significant charitable gift, like it being bantered about or publicized. You know, the ribbon cutting ceremony or the athlete given 9,300 turkey dinners to the impoverished or whatever, putting your name on a building or medical center, the Parker Petit renaming Georgia State, right?
Football stadium for the audience.
Yeah, football stadium.
You know, the Mark Cahotas football stadium soon enough. Yeah.
Well, I mean, I went to Babson College. I could, you know, 300 grand buys a lot of scholarships, you know, to people. So, I mean, I give a lot and I never talk about it because it's no one's business and I don't need publicity for it. So I gave it to Boyd. Didn't say boo. I guess one day it appears on his donor list or this, that, and the other, and the troll crowd picks up on this and somehow spins it. I don't even know how that I've used Overstock stock to pay off Roddy Boyd so Roddy Boyd would never say anything bad about Overstock, which is the most ridiculous thing known to man. And I donated him the stock at 60. The stock went to 90. The stock then went to 4. Now it's God knows where. It's higher than where I donated to Boyd. And these guys made such a big deal about this. It made it to the point where I said, I can't, you know, you don't want to give anything to anybody because no deed goes unpunished. I mean, what am I don't even know what the hell I was supposed to do. And then on the crazy thing is Roddy wrote a bad piece on Frazier, who I, you know, I think does great research. And I'm mentioned in there, not in a flattering way, you know, which is fine. If everyone wants to knock me down, everyone goes and takes a shot. But, you know, this whole concept that, you know, I have not given Roddy Boyd an idea since he's been at Surf. You know, that's a fact. And you know, you can't, you try to do something right in a non-public way, and you get blasted for it. And I think the guys who did it are very jealous of Roddy, that he actually has a job and not a troll, and is trying to do some good in the world. And these guys are jealous and envious, and will take whatever you do to try to knock people down, which is really sad. So I don't know how he got caught up in it and the whole thing to it, but it's just awful. I mean, it's just terrible what went on. But what can you do? You know, I don't I view myself as a generational player. I think people are extraordinarily jealous of me and my success and what I've done. And they'll do whatever they can to try to knock me down. And someone sent me an email that I literally read every morning, right? And I think it came from a MiMedx whistleblower, but I don't know. And this, I'll just read the part I read every day. It says, I recognize that many of these people get so obsessed with their financial agenda, they will spew hate regardless of the facts. I know what you did here. And I know that I would have been completely annihilated had you not been goaded into this fight by Pete. You are an easy target for the Noceras, the Antars, and the Weisses of the world. Because unless you're perfect in your thesis, people will attack you, and they will attack you hard. But this experience has taught me that people are idiots, especially when money is their driving force. You did the right thing. You continue to do the right thing. And if these idiots saw once how you care for your son, your wife, and the people who you are loyal to, they would be ashamed of themselves. Have a wonderful Thanksgiving and try to remember what's really at play with MiMedx. You know, it just sort of breaks me up each time I read it, because people, no one knows, you know, how hard this truly is, how hard it truly is. And back to the letting go of the rope, you know, I just refuse to let go of the rope and let these just no good rat bastard motherfuckers win. And I apologize for that language. It can't happen. You know, there's just too much on the line on good versus evil on this. And I am not going to take guff from these horrifically bad folk. Just not.
Well, that's a great note to have. And I have no doubt that that's something that gives you a lot of comfort, perhaps, in some of the dark moments in trying to continue to pursue these, that there are, you know, individuals, you know, that are kind of small in their own ways that see that without multiple people, yourself included, kind of continuing to bang the drum, that they would feel very much alone. And I think that's a big part of this, you know, trying to shine a light on some of these things, is that people can feel very much alone and overpowered, and that they're screaming into the void. You know, Roddy Boyd has just shown up in so many different areas of fraud where his work has, you know, just been really unique. I mean, even watching what occurred with Valiant and some of the ways that he was able to kind of pull apart some of the mystery there with Philidor, and he just kind of keeps popping up everywhere. So, you know, I'm certainly thankful that his kind of journalism outlet continues to thrive.
Really, at the end of the day, right? Now, people can like Roddy and they can hate Roddy. I know Fraser and him are not on good terms. That's okay.
That's an understatement.
Right? Okay, yeah. That's fine. That's an episode all of itself, I'm sure. Okay. Right, but that's, you know, that's not my fight, right? I was dragged in. My name was mentioned. Fine. I'm a big boy. People want to take shots of me. No problem. Even Roddy. Roddy, he wants to take shots of me. Great. But has the world been made better for Roddy Boyd being around the last 3 years? Yes or no?
Absolutely.
I would argue horrifically yes. Without my donation, Roddy Boyd would not be around in the current form. Okay, that is a fact. That is a fact of life. So if my donation gets criticized because it was an overstock stock, Holmes, who's doing the criticizing? Who cares about these clowns? Who cares? But they get agitated because they have nothing to do, and they pay $3 to show up to boo Reggie Jackson. You know, that's all they do. They show up. They've never done anything in their lives except try to rain on people's parade. And I think Roddy's moved the needle. You know, and I'm not asking to be on the board, and I'm not asking for my name outside of the Surf building. I mean, it's remarkable. But you know, I try not to dwell on it. I try to block people, and you know, I just go from there. So you want to talk some Camping World?
Absolutely. Which I was going to say is probably all parade, no rain, but I'm sure there's rain there too, just like everywhere. But you made a really terrific call on Camping World earlier this year. And I have to say, I had the week prior to your interview with Grant Williams, where you highlighted the call on Camping World and were going long, the week prior we were in the office and I said, you know, I think this is going to be the year of the road trip. And TC and I chatted about it a little bit. And then when I heard your interview, I was recovering from emergency surgery, and I was kind of smugly gratified to hear you talk about Camping World. And I thought, yeah. And then I did nothing about it. And so I've been blaming kind of post-surgical fog for my, for not taking advantage of the opportunity, particularly seeing where Camping World has been trading over the subsequent months. But talk with us about how that went on your radar, why Camping World versus, you know, Winnebago and some of its other peers, but also what you see in Marcus Lemonis, because he seems to be one of the critical factors here, and a little bit like everything he touches is gold. So talk to us a little bit about your perspective on the name.
So back into the stalking point of view, you know, when you're old like me, you know a lot of people. And someone I'm happy to call a really good friend is David Abrams in Boston. And he owns some of the Raiders. I'm a huge Raider fan, and we go to some games together. Seems like a lot of my friends has a Raider sort of theme through it. And I view him as very, very, very smart. And my son and I were back east last fall seeing Collective Soul, and we had lunch. We had breakfast with Abrams. And Abrams is the biggest holder of Camping World. And the stock at the time was 10, and it's down from 48. And I said, I'm very intrigued with this Camping World. And he was telling me the story that he thinks this thing could become, you know, the next big thing next to auto dealers, that Camping World basically owns the market. It's a fragmented market. He can keep taking market share and on and on and on, and how the lifetime value of the customer is worth a lot, this, that, and the other. So I bought a little bit at 8, and then it went to 17, then we had COVID. And then out of the woodwork come all these haters, because Camping World has some leverage on the balance sheet, saying the consumer's broke and this, that, and the other, and Camping World's going to go bankrupt. And there was this one clown who put something out on Seeking Alpha at about $5. Said Camping World's going to go bankrupt. They're going to have a significant liquidity event in Q2, blah, 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 blah. You know, Marcus Lemonis is a bad guy. He's bad people, on and on and on. And I just said, you know, I said to myself, because I sort of talk to myself sometimes, I can have the argument both ways. You know, there's the good mark and the bad mark. I said, you know, I've been in RV stocks long and short probably 23, 24 times in my life, both long and short. And when it's the most dark, you're supposed to buy it. And I was thinking with the virus that the only way people are going to be able to do anything as far as the eye can see, and this is in February, is to camp. And if you search the world, there's only one company with camping in its name, and that's Camping World. And I called up Abrams, and I said, can this thing go broke? He goes, not anytime soon. They have ample liquidity and this, that, and the other. He goes, you want to talk to Marcus? I said, yeah, I'd like to talk to Marcus. So we dial up Marcus, and he said, I'd like to meet my friend Mark Cahotas, this, that, and the other. And I said, hey, I don't watch TV, so I don't know he's a TV guy. You know, I don't know about that Profit show because I won't watch the Cartoon Network. And I said, you know, Marcus, I see in the past couple weeks you bought like 250,000 shares for yourself personally. I said, why? He goes, because the stock is just overdone on the downside. You know, I know we have too much leverage. It's my fault. He says, I screwed it up with the Gander acquisition, but we're going to be okay. I said, can you go broke? He says, we are not going broke. I got plenty of liquidity and this, that, and the other. And I said, here's my theory on camping. Is it possible? He goes, everything's going to get shut down. You know, the question is, when do things reopen? And it goes back to my Trump. It went back to my Trump theme that I stated in, I think at some conference I was at in Vegas, that the only thing Trump has is the stock market. And there's no way they were going to allow this thing to stay closed. And there'd be an insurrection if they didn't open up the world by, I figured, June. And I figure you're not going to get on a plane. You're not going to go to a hotel. You're not going to go to baseball. You're not going to see Collective Soul. The only thing you're going to do is camp. And I own an RV. I actually own two of them. I own a big one and I own a smaller one. And it's a lot of fun. And people don't understand that the economics, once you own one, you know, you spend a lot of money on stuff, disposables and parts and service and things like that. So I think Camping World's business model is great. And I looked at people's numbers and I said, you know, this whole story about the consumer being broke is really wrong. Because, yeah, I understand that if you have a kitchen job or you're a waiter or a chef or someone like that, I totally understand how money is tight. But for the average person working, you have a lot of money right now because you're not spending it on anything, right? You're not doing anything. You're not going out to eat. You're not going to the movies. You're not going to concerts. You have money. So the one thing that people would do, I thought, would be to camp. And it turns out, you know, I hit the ball hard. And I think Camping World's business, I cannot wait to see their quarter and what Marcus says next Wednesday. Because the one thing I know about him, he like myself, has lovers and he has haters. And he has haters because he puts himself out there and he tries to make a difference. And when you put yourself out there and try to make a difference, you by and large have people who want to see you fail. And in this Marcus Lemonis, I see a little bit of me, where this guy is a driven, he is a driven, driven, driven man. And that guy is on the front of the steering wheel and he is determined, determined to make this work, and in a big way. And I think he is literally just crushing people. It's a fragmented industry. I like the stock a lot. It's gone from 4 to, I don't know, 35, something like that. And I think this thing can go to 70. I think it can go to 100, frankly, because what's going to happen is he only has 20% market share. And the rest of his competition are these regional mom-pa guys. And he can play big stack of chips against little stack of chips and push guys around. And I think he can make acquisitions. And I have no clue what the numbers are going to be. I think they're going to be better than what people think. But the one concept, and hopefully this comes out before Wednesday when he prints the quarter, so they don't think that I did it after the fact, demand is really strong in towables and in RVs. And in the past, when demand was kind of good, but bad, you know, just iffy, you could get big discounts on these things. You could go into the dealer and negotiate. There is no negotiation anymore. If you want it, you are paying the sticker. So I think not only are his sales strong, I think his gross margins on product are through the roof. So I think you're going to beat on the top line. I think you're going to beat on margins. I think he has ample leverage, and this guy is determined. I mean, he has turpentine up his ass. I mean, when I spoke with him after the last quarter, which is the last time I talked to him, he is just, his voice literally cracks. Like when my voice cracked reading that thing that person sent me, his voice cracks on how determined he is. In the street, there's one guy who's recommending it. It's Stevens, and I think the guy's about 97 years old. There's four guys with holds who've fought the trade the whole way, and there's four guys with sells, and they fought the trade the whole way. And again, just because you miss a trade early on doesn't mean that you need to be a hater on the trade. You can just simply say, I missed it. You don't need to disrespect Marcus Lemonis with sell, 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 sell when it's clear. You know, I'm in Montana now with my longtime pal, Greg Reyes. Every fourth vehicle on Interstate 90, Interstate 80, Interstate 15, U.S. Highway 89, every fourth vehicle is either an RV or a towable. And I'm not in the mood, right? And I think if you're a skeptic on this thing, I think you're going to get absolutely destroyed. I may be wrong, but that's just my opinion. I think you're going to get destroyed. So I like this thing a lot. So I'm sort of I'm a two-stock guy. I got Overstock as my righty and Camping World is my lefty. And I'm going to, you know, or OSTKO is my righty and Camping World's my lefty. But it's been great, and I'm going to ride the horse till the horse throws me in the river.
That's clear. If there's anything that's clear to the audience from the 90 plus minutes we've been talking is that you don't do anything half-assed. As long as we're going to have a cussing show, I figured I'd throw one in.
Yeah, get in there, too.
But listen, Mark, it's been really a wonderful 90 minutes. You know, any closing comments for the audience as we wrap up?
Well, I know you have a diverse crowd, and it's a sophisticated crowd, but ladies and gentlemen of all ages, you're far smarter than the trolls and the people who preach hate. And I think if you think for yourself and you think clearly and you understand it, and you can gain conviction and understanding of what you're in, I think you go with it. I always say that never short a stock if you're a home gamer or not a professional. It's extraordinarily dangerous, and you can lose an absolute fortune quickly. But if you can find a theme, or you can find someone, a company that's doing better, not some get-rich-quick COVID or whatever scheme, I think by and large, if you think for yourself and don't get trolled out or scared out of a trade, I think you actually have a chance in this world. I think you have a chance. I'm not a macro guy. I'm not a bullish or bearish, you know, per se on the market. I'm not a currency, gold. I just try to find names that I think can work, doing better, or a rascal who I can put an axe in their forehead. And I think, you know, I have a very sharp axe at home, and I cannot wait to put it in someone's forehead when the time is right. But I've wanted to do this for a while. I've wanted to be fresh. I wanted to have something to say. Wanted to get stuff off my chest. I don't want people to feel bad for me. I don't want people to pity me. I don't want people to say, God, that's just a bitch. I want people to say, that guy will see it through. And I can't wait to see what happens with his FBI lawsuit, the DOJ lawsuit, and let's see how this Overstock, T-Zero, and Camping World play out.
Well, Mark, next time you're ready to get the axe out again, you let us know. We'd love to have you back on.
All metaphorically, of course.
Yes, of course.
we don't need another visit.
Exactly. Right. Well, we need another visit from you, but you don't need one from the FBI. Listen, Mark, it's been great. You've been more than generous with your time. Come back anytime on the show. We'll be happy to have you.
Okay. Thanks, guys. Thanks for having me. That was a lot of fun.
My name's Tesler, Poles Tesler. The stories you just heard were all true. No names were changed to protect the innocent or the guilty. Today we learned that Makahotis is not one to back away from a fight. You call the law on him? Well, you just better be right. In these days when some say regulators and law enforcement can be bought, I say to you, it's dangerous times, to be a short. But keep at it. Someday you will see. The jaguar just might fall out of that tree. Bum-ba-dum-bum. Bum-ba-dum-bum-bum.